Hello, everybody. We are the Harvard Callbacks, and we'd like to wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day. Someone has ordered a very special Valentine's Day message, Anna, to her roommate, Sarah Stapleton. I hope you're here by now. And this is also a special Valentine's Day message from Tall, Jessica, your entire Psych 1504 teaching staff to you. Yay. So happy Valentine's Day.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Valentine's, everyone.
Just a quick clarification. So when, by the way, I'm a huge fan of a cappella. This is, I tried many times for an a cappella group, never made it. And in retrospect, for good reason, but I'm still a fan. So when the callbacks, you know, told me that they'd like to dedicate a song, first of all, I didn't know it was to Sarah Stapleton, who's my thesis advisee. Lucky me. But then I said, you know, why don't you dedicate it to the whole class, from the teaching staff. I didn't know they were going to sing this particular song, so. but I guess, you know, you take it metaphorically, right? before I begin and jump into the material this week, I want to just, many of you have written to me, both from 1504 and 1508, with great questions. You know, those of you taking 1508, you know, you were beautiful enemies, and really beautiful. So thank you for that. And as I said before, I will respond to every single question, some of them just one-on-one, others, especially ones that repeat themselves, I'll respond to the entire class. So I wanna just read to you from an email that Shom Tanguturi wrote. With some questions, and these are also questions that were asked by other people that I think are important to clarify. And with his permission, of course, I'm quoting. He said, I'm not clear about the outlier argument you made in class. Remember we talked about Maslow's work of studying the best? Although you presented a variety of studies that may suggest that human nature is genetically predetermined and unchangeable, your argument against these findings was that there were outliers. And he said, why don't you talk about some examples? So let me repeat some of the things in more length that I talked about in lecture. So why do we study the best? I mean, what is it about Maslow's notion of tip of the stem statistics, where he says this is where the action happens? Why should we study as opposed to studying the average, which is what most psychology does, right? Studying the average, then finding the mean, looking at statistical significance, coming with a p-value, and there we have a good result. So, but what Maslow was saying almost 50 years ago, yeah, we need to do that. We need to study the average, but even more importantly, we need to study the elite. We need to study the best, whether it's the best Olympic athletes, whether it's the most virtuous people, the most successful people, the happiest people. What is the justification for this quote-unquote elitist approach to research? And what I argued in the lecture was that by studying these outliers, we can then apply what we learn from them to everyone else. And this is the question that Chom asked me to clarify this idea. So let me give you a few examples. One of them very relevant to today, Valentine's Day, relationships. As I said in the lecture, if we had studied the average relationship throughout history, we would have been studying a relationship in which the woman was subjugated. This was the average relationship throughout history and in large parts of the world today, still, unfortunately. But instead, what the great thinkers on the topics, one of them being John Stuart Mill, were doing, or what another researcher, which we'll talk about later in the semester, was doing, someone by the name of Gottman, G-O-T-T-M-A-N, we'll touch on him later. What they were doing were studying the best relationships. Not the average, but the best. And from the best, and then they came with prescriptions. Remember, the average describes, the best prescribes. They came with prescriptions for what makes a great relationship. So this is one area where the outliers were able to inform the average, the average relationship. Another example was meditation. Remember I said, if you want to study meditation, you don't study the practices of the person on the street. You go to Tibet and you study people who have meditated for many years. And it was as a result of this the studies of people who have meditated for 20 years or more, done by Richard Davidson, who's not Wisconsin, but started his work here in William James. It's because of work by him studying the elite, the best meditators in the world, that they were able to identify certain practices and then bring them to people like me, you know, the average meditator. And I was able to benefit from it a great deal. And I'll talk a lot about meditation and what we learn from these exceptional, elitist, so to speak, meditators. Another example that we talked about was resilient kids. Remember initially when they studied inner city kids, what they studied was the average. Well, the average, you know, didn't quote unquote make it. But then they started to ask, what about these exceptional ones who did make it? And when they started to study them, they realized that there were a few characteristics that they could then apply to the average person in the inner city. The outliers, the exceptional kids, were able to inform psychologists and practitioners and then help them treat kids who are more quote unquote average, even though I don't even know what that means. I mean, what's an average kid? And the other example was Marva Collins. Certainly an outlier, certainly not your typical teacher. But through her practices, we were able, and through her writings, we were able to learn, I was able to learn what I wanted to be as a teacher. Also, next year, you're gonna have, those of you still here, Brian Little is gonna be teaching a class here. He taught personality psychology 2 years ago. I guess one of you has taken his class. 270 of you have actually taken his class. So he's gonna be here, and I TF'd for him his first year. And the second year, I didn't actually have time to TF, but I decided to TF again because I wanted to learn from him as a teacher. Again, an outlier, except phenomenal teacher, and we can learn a great deal from them. And this is Maslow's idea, and it's a very powerful idea. It sounds commonsensical to me, it sounds commonsensical after I read Maslow. But it's not an idea that's being practiced in mainstream psychology. And as I said, within the positive psychology class, one thing is that we are going to focus more on positive psychological research, but the second thing, we are going to study the best, the tip of the stem, to use Maslow's term. Another question that came up a lot, and also that Sean brought up, is about the Cambridge Somerville study. It's a very disturbing result, that study, right? Millions of dollars over many years with the best minds in the world. Why did it fail? And let me say a few more words about why it failed. Again, to repeat what I said, but to elaborate. One of the reasons why it failed was because the kids, by the end of the study or during the study, were getting a sense of entitlement. We deserve all this attention on us. We deserve all these tutors. We deserve all these psychologists. They weren't made to work hard for what they got. And over time, they probably got lazy, which explains why they were actually less ambitious than the control group. Contrast this with the Marva Collins approach, which is going to the kids, making them believe in themselves, but also making them work extremely hard. Also, the idea about the good intentions with raising people's self-esteem, showering them with praise. You're wonderful, you're terrific. That's not enough. And if it's only showering them with praise, without also making them pay and work hard for the praise, it's counterproductive. Going back to our idea of the practical idealists, there are many idealists with good intentions, but impractical. And with their good intentions, they may be creating more harm than good, as was the situation with the Cambridge Somerville study. Now, does this mean we shouldn't intervene? Absolutely not. You know that this is very much a class about creating these interventions. The only thing we need to do is intervene in the right way. And this is where psychology can help. This is where research can help. Can help us to see, so this kind of intervention works, this doesn't. This is what I'm going to apply. And the more we know about these interventions that work, which we're going to talk about throughout the semester, the more practical idealists we can become. Before I move on, are there any questions or any clarifications? Am I not seeing anyone? Okay. Again, please do continue asking questions, raising issues, because it also helps me to get a sense of what's clear, what's not clear, also in my mind. Some of the questions that were raised and I responded to in the emails helped me clarify these ideas. So remember last time we started talking about the basic premises of this class. One premise was the interdisciplinary nature of it, that we'll draw on psychology, psychopathology, not just positive psychology, that we'll draw on cognitive psychology, that we'll draw on philosophy, history, interdisciplinary nature. And the second premise that we talked about was whether change was possible or not. And while we said that change was possible, is possible, we also realized how difficult change is. And that psychology doesn't always have good news for us. But psychology is not about giving good news, it's about giving realistic news. So change is difficult. Personal change is difficult. Societal change is even more difficult. But it's possible. The third premise, and I'm going to argue for the first, that internal factors primarily determine happiness rather than external circumstances. This premise very much is related to the second premise about change being hard. Let me introduce you to some of the research. Some of you may know about it because a lot of it is done right here in William James. Research about subjective well-being. Now, the term subjective well-being is interesting in and of itself. This is what psychologists call happiness. So when you hear subjective well-being, SWB, in a psychology department, they're talking about happiness. But why are they using this term? Not only because it sounds fancier than happiness, maybe we'll get you published more often. It's not just that. It's because this is what they're measuring. The way they're measuring happiness is through self-reports. In other words, they're asking people, how happy are you? And one responds, 1 to 5, very happy or very unhappy. or more elaborate questionnaires, but it's ultimately about people's subjective evaluation of how they're feeling, as opposed to objective happiness. Now, recently, last decade or two, there have been more and more studies trying to measure happiness in a more, quote unquote, objective manner. So fMRI is the in methodology now. And we're gonna talk about the fMRI studies studying happiness when we talk about meditation. But most of the research done on happiness has been done through questionnaires. The interesting though is that they've started to find very high correlations between subjective well-being and the objective measures of how your brain actually works or functions or fires, you know, how the neurons are firing. So they have found high correlation between the quote-unquote objective measures and the subjective measures. But a lot of the studies that I'm gonna report now will be the subjective well-being research, which has its limitations, as you can imagine. But here are the interesting things that they found. Our very own, and some of you I'm sure took Psych 1 with Professor Gilbert, has done very interesting research. And let me describe to you just a couple of his findings. So here is what he did. What he wanted to show was how well people predict their levels of happiness or unhappiness in the future. So one of his studies he did with his colleagues, psychology professors, and he went to professors who were just before, this was, you know, top university, just before their tenure or non-tenure decision. So they were up for tenure and they were gonna hear pretty soon whether they were gonna get tenure or not. Very tense period in a psychologist or in an academic's life. Especially, you know, if you're at a top university, this is something that you've been dreaming of for a long time. So he asked the professors the following questions. First, how happy do you think you'll be if you get tenure? To which the professors almost unanimously said, extremely happy. You know, this is something I've been working on for the last 15 years, you know, since I started grad school. I've been publishing like crazy, and this really will be the peak of my career, of my experience. And then he asked the second question. How long will you be happy for? To which they said, for the rest of our lives. I mean, this is the thing I've been working on. This is what will make or break my happiness. And then he said, what if you don't get tenure? I'll be completely distraught. You know, this is the university where I want to get tenure. This is what I've been working for. How long will you be distraught for? Oh, for a very long time, probably until I get tenure somewhere else, and I don't know if it will be as good, but for a very long time. And then he went to them again, right after their tenure decision. Those who got tenure, how happy are you? Ecstatic. This is what I've been dreaming on about my entire life. And how long are you gonna be? Well, this has changed my life. I no longer need to worry about the publish or perish. You know, think about the things going through their minds right after they get tenure. Ecstasy. And then he went to the ones who didn't get tenure and he asked them, how are you feeling? Completely distraught, as predicted. How long are you gonna be unhappy for? Well, I don't know, I mean, this is really serious, it's depressing. And then he went to them again a few months later. Oh, and by the way, he measured their levels of happiness before they got tenure to get a base level. He went to them a few months later, and what he found, that both groups, those that got tenure and those that didn't get tenure, returned to their base level of happiness. No significant difference between how happy they were before the tenure decision and a few months after the tenure decision. If it was a down after, they bounced back up. If it was an up, because they got tenure, they fell back down to their base level of happiness. They did this research. This was done at Northwestern University. Philip Brickman, social psychologist, with lottery winners. He asked the general audience, how happy will you be if you win the state lottery? I don't know, $10 million, whatever. How happy will you be? Ecstatic, most people would say. For how long? Well, for the rest of my life. It's going to change my life. I no longer have to work where I don't want to work. You know, I can be my own boss. I can do whatever I want to do. I can have a big home. I don't have to worry about the mortgage. My life will change. And then he went to actual lottery winners. And what he found was right after they won, ecstatic. How long are you going to be happy for? It changed my life. But then when he went back to them, some of them, as little as a month after, most after about 6 months, returned back to their base level of happiness. The lottery did not make a difference to what I call in my book the ultimate currency, their happiness levels. Think about when you got into Harvard, when you got that phone call, when you got that big envelope. How happy were you? Well, if I had to go, I've seen one person get that envelope. I've seen how he behaves in the mirror. And it was pretty silly. Wah, wah, right? Is that, am I the only crazy one or no? Probably others. So, it changed my life. I got into the place of, you know, I've been dreaming about this for a long time. And you know this exercise continued through freshman week. The people here are amazing. I can't believe I'm here. They must have made a mistake. You know, the usual, but I'm glad they made the mistake. You know. And then classes begin. Oh yes, that's what we do at Harvard. We have classes, we have grades, and the pressure begins. And we go back usually to our base level of happiness. This is the way it works. It's not good news, but it's true news. You know, this is what psychology is about, telling us what's happening. This is the way our graph looks. We go back to our base level of happiness, which, by the way, explains a lot of things. I mean, why do you think there are so many extremely successful people? I'm talking the best, extremely. Rock stars, you know, movie stars, top athletes, very famous and successful business people who are depressed. Why are there so many of them? Because what keeps them going throughout their lives is, once I get there, then I'll be happy. And then they get there, and there is no there there. What do I do now? I'm lost. And they get depressed. And many choose alternative ways of feeling the rush and the high. That's why drugs, that's why alcohol is so prevalent with extremely successful people. Because what now? Because until now they were sustained by the belief that when I get there, then I'll be happy. When I get into Harvard, then I'll be happy. When I get my dream job at Goldman or McKinsey or Teach for America, then I'll be happy. When I become a manager, when I become famous, then I'll be happy. It doesn't work that way. We return back to our base level of happiness. And there's more work on this that shows this. Work by Ed Diner, probably the leading researcher on subjective well-being. Teaches at in Illinois, one of the founders of the positive psychology movement. He shows similar results. Income matters very little to levels of happiness. Above GDP of $8,000, income matters very little to the national level of happiness. There's very little in terms of a person earning $800,000 versus $8,000 a year. I'm not talking about the US, you know, in places where $8,000 you can actually live on. Very little difference between someone living in a chateau and someone living in a modest home, controlling for everything else. Income makes very little difference. Why? Because we adapt. We adapt, and initially when we get a raise, I mean, I remember my first paycheck, I thought it will change my life because I'm making a lot of money now. It was $1,000. But I got used to it, and then when I got $3,000, I got used to that too. Now that I'm making $300, kid, I won't get used to that. Income matters very little. There's also no change across generations. So our generation is much wealthier than, you know, 50 years ago. No change in the levels of happiness. Why? Because we adapt. Also, counter to popular belief, living in California will not make you happier. Not true. I know. That's what the lottery winner said. Except for, by the way, people who have a SAD, season affective disorder, where it really does make a difference, you know, being more in the sun. So that does make a difference. But other than that, in terms of place of residence, doesn't matter. But the most important thing that we can derive from this research is, really, it doesn't matter that much where you live. Whether you live here or there. I love this t-shirt. If you can't run with the big dogs, stay in the yard. Harsh words. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to our levels of happiness. Yeah, initially, all you want to do is be in the yard, you return back to your base level. Told you this was an applied class. There is one difference, or there is one element that does make a difference to subjective well-being, and that is whether you live under a democracy or not, there is significant difference between levels of happiness of people living in democracies and people living in dictatorships. There is a significant difference for women living in countries where they're oppressed versus living in countries where they're free. So on the whole, there's certainly a difference between levels of happiness in Darfur and levels of happiness in Cambridge. But other than these conditions, extreme and terrible conditions, external circumstances make very little difference. So going back to our question, so is change elusive? So wait a minute, so I'm striving for all this, for the best job, for the best grades, but it won't really matter in terms of it won't matter that much in terms of your happiness in the long term. Well, what Gilbert's work and what Ed Diener's work is saying is not that change is elusive. What it's saying is the following, that these things won't make a difference to your happiness. Living in luxury homes or having all the money or driving a great car, or getting straight A's, or getting tenured. These things will not make the difference. What will make a difference? Our readiness and potential to experience happiness is mostly dependent on our state of mind, not on our status or the state of our bank account. This is the take home from these studies. In other words, what matters is the inside, not the outside. And the challenge is, how do we change that inside? And we started talking about it, and as from next lecture, especially on next Tuesday, we'll actually start talking about techniques. What do we do to change the internal? So some of the things that we do, meditation, I told you, quite literally transforms, change the shape of our neural pathways, changing the internal. Other things that we can do to change the way we look at the world. In other words, to reach transformation as opposed to just information, to change the shape, the structure of our mind. And the other things that help are learning to interpret events differently. And we'll talk about cognitive behavioral therapy and what they do. Another thing, and this is research done by by Ali Karam, who is one of the TFs, and also by Megan Doherty on exercise. Exercise makes a big difference. Exercising regularly. And we'll devote a class to that, on what it actually does to the way we perceive the world, to our base level of happiness. Cultivating self-esteem changes the way we look at the world. Because if I have low self-esteem, all the praise in the world will not help me feel better about myself. Whereas if I learn to cultivate self-esteem, it will increase my base level of happiness. Yes, question. Good, I'm glad you brought that up. The other thing about this is that we focused on the average. So just reinforces, I wanted to bring that point up, I didn't. What this shows is that the average person goes back to the base level. Now, are there people who won the lottery and they transformed their lives? I'm sure there are. Why? Because they used it. They said, well, let me see now what I can focus on and cultivate within myself. But most people go back to their base level. Now, are there people who got tenured and that changed their lives? I'm sure there are, because then they said, okay, so let me focus on the things that provide me meaning, that provide me pleasure in life, because I don't need to please the reviewers anymore. But there are few and far between. So we're going to study these people exactly here and see, okay, so what can we learn from those people who did change their lives as a result of external circumstances? Other things that we're going to talk about are crucibles or difficult experiences and how these change some people's life. It was something external. You know, some people change for the better. Other people experience post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of these experiences. And we're going to talk about how can we fall on the side of benefiting from these. Yeah, follow up. Right, so the question is about adapting, right? So we adapt to our base level of happiness. There are certain things that we adapt to. There are certain things that keep us on a higher level of happiness. Let me give you just a personal example. So for instance, getting into Harvard, I adapted to. You know, I'm here, I've been here for the last 15 years almost. You know, I don't do this anymore other than in the gym and for different reasons, as you can see. So the question then is, what are the things that we don't adapt to? One of the things that I don't adapt to that really did raise my level of happiness is what I'm dealing with every day. It's great waking up in the morning and reading articles on happiness. You know, it's great waking up in the morning and writing, because I love to write. You know, I love to write when I was an undergrad here with the Crimson, and I love to write today. These are the things that when I do regularly, I don't adapt to. They have literally raised my levels of happiness. If you won the lottery regularly, and every time you won more and more, then maybe you will experience more highs, but that's not the way life works. Maybe, I don't know. It's an empirical question. But again, what we're concerned about is raising the base level. We're concerned about not just the ups and the downs, which are important, but we're concerned about raising the base level of happiness. Let me move on. Premise number four, human nature must be obeyed, which I'm going to argue for, versus human nature must be perfected. This question is central to the history of political thought, psychological thought, to the history of philosophy. is our nature fixed, our instincts and inclinations fixed, or can we actually change them? Can we modify them? Thomas Sowell, Harvard class of 58, now at the Stanford, the Hoover Institute at Stanford, wrote the book A Conflict of Vision that helped me understand where I stand politically and also helped me understand where other people are standing politically. Now, for all those of you who are interested in going into politics, if there's one book you want to read, really, phenomenal, will help you understand yourselves and the political scene in general. And here is what Thomas Sowell says. He's a philosopher, but it very much applies to what we were talking about. He says, going back to our basic premise, that you can divide political thinkers into two realms. One side of the continuum will say, has the constrained vision, that human nature is fixed, we can't really change it. The other side has the unconstrained vision. We need to perfect human nature, we need to improve it. Utopianism. The constrained vision, according to Sowell, accepts that human nature is immutable. Our instincts, our inclinations are fixed. There's nothing we can do about them. We can decide to act accordingly or against our inclinations, but it's fixed, it's there. The constrained vision says that flaws are inevitable in our nature. It is what it is. We can't really do anything about it. What we need to do is to accept these flaws, and then most importantly, after we accept these flaws, okay, one more. That was two, what? Three. Four. Okay. Is there no, I mean, do people not listen here to the teachers? I mean, no authority whatsoever. I'm glad you're not doing this in the leadership class. I mean, this really would have undermined my leadership. Okay. So this is what the constrained vision. Is it okay? Enough? Oh, with no flesh, okay, thanks. It's weird. I'm gonna flunk you. Doesn't work, he's not taking the class. So, and what the role of the philosopher, of the psychologist, of the politician to do is to take our flawed nature and to channel it toward positive directions, right? This is the constrained vision. Some political thinkers who thought this way, Adam Smith, Edmund Burke, Ayn Rand, Hayek, Alexander Hamilton. These are some of the people who were part, according to Sowell, of the constrained vision. Then we have the other extreme. Oh, and what captures this is a sentence which Francis Bacon said, talked about, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. We cannot change it, we cannot perfect it. If we want to control it, we need to obey it. And then we can channel it in the right direction. The other extreme, the unconstrained vision. Nature can be improved. It is perfectible. Solutions exist to all of our problems that are as a result of our flawed nature. And the role of psychologists, philosophers, politicians is to help mold that nature, to change it. In the words, or people that supported this view also, some of the leading thinkers in history. People like Rousseau was among these. Other people, George Bernard Shaw falls here. For those philosopher, Ronald Dworkin was also on this side. It captures best by French philosopher and politician Benjamin Constant. It is for self-perfectioning that destiny calls us. Now the implications of this are wide, and this is where Sowell comes in so powerfully, that he shows how having one vision versus the other leads to radically different results. So for instance, usually, again, not always, but usually people who are on the constrained vision side would be the capitalists, people like Adam Smith. Human nature is as it is. We have self-interest. We're not going to change this self-interest. But how can we channel it? How can we make use of this invisible hand and channel it in the right directions to the betterment of everyone? Compare this, the unconstrained vision, very often connected to communism, utopianism. No, we can change human nature. We can eradicate the self-interest, the selfishness. And we can make this society a better society. Can you see the difference in the implications of this? One says, let's use nature. The other says, let's fight our nature. And throughout history, what Sowell does, and I'm not doing justice to his book, I do highly recommend it, is show how these two come in conflict with one another based on their basic assumptions of human nature. Can it be changed or not? Now, this very much applies to psychology. It very much applies to psychology. Now, it doesn't mean that if you're in psychology, you're on the constrained, that politically you're necessarily on the constrained. So there are people who are in the psychological realm on the constrained, and in the political realm are on the unconstrained. Whoa. Sexy. Yeah. This is for Valentine's Day. You won't get it every other day. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Good question. Isn't it quite difficult to determine what human nature is? It is very difficult. And this is where psychology comes in. This is where research comes in. And as I'll mention in 2 minutes, advice, anyone? What would you do if you were me? HUPD, okay, that's one. Any football players here? Leverett, no. Just one second, I'm gonna have a talk with him. I told him that if he really wants to be happy, he needs to stop right now. And I wasn't just talking about a peak, I was talking about the base level of happiness. So, you know, serious stuff here. So, but he told me he doesn't want to be happy. So, it's a choice, you know, happiness is a choice, you know. He's gonna be a couple of more minutes. So one of psychology's role is exactly that, you know, through rigorous study of human nature to identify, you know, what it is that, what is that nature, that elusive nature. And today we have more tools than we had 200 years ago. 100 years from now, they're gonna look back at us and say that these were the Middle Ages, because they're gonna have much better tools of measuring human nature. So you're right, it's a big question, and it is very difficult. But there are certain things that people can agree on. For example, that we have a selfish gene, everyone can agree on, or not everyone, most people can agree on. Many people also agree that we have a generous or a benevolent gene. And the question is, what do we do with that selfish gene? What do we do with our generosity or benevolence? People are not looking at me. He is. strange. Thank you. Good. Done. Yeah. Can't the idea that you can perfect human nature be also dangerous? Those on this side, the constrained vision, would argue yes. Those on this side would say, we can't afford to have the constrained vision. We have to improve it. This is why there is such a big clash here in philosophy, in politics, but also in psychology. Let me share with you my vision of psychology, where I think a healthy psychology falls. To my mind, a healthy psychology falls on the constrained side of human nature, that there are certain limitations to our nature, that human nature is immutable, that we have certain instincts, we have certain inclinations, certain wants, that are unchangeable. And while circumstances change, while fashions change, while the world changes and technology changes, our human nature, its foundation is immutable. It doesn't change. And the role of psychology, going back to your question, is to understand this nature. What is this nature is about? Let's run studies, whether it's in the lab, in the real world, to understand what this nature is about. And once we understand it, how can we make the best use of it? Again, once we obey it, we understand it, we adhere to it, how can we make the best use of it? And this is what I believe will lead to ultimate happiness. If we understand our nature and then make best use of it, not if we try and change it. Because I believe that we cannot change it. And if we try to change it, maybe in the political realm, it could be dangerous. In the psychological realm, and again, it's not necessary that philosophically you're in one area and psychologically you're in the same area. So there are people who politically think one thing, psychologically think another. But if you try and change this nature, you will encounter a brick wall. It will be a Sisyphean battle, one you can never win. It will lead to frustration and unhappiness. Let me say more about this. Let me talk about one of the central pillars of this class, and for me, one of the central pillars of a fulfilling life. This is the one understanding that I gained through reading and through introspection that has contributed a great deal to my happiness. And it was when I gave myself the permission to be human. This is also the title of my next book, one that I'm working on and one that you'll be reading excerpts from when we talk about perfectionism. But I want to introduce this idea here. The permission to be human. What does this mean? It means accepting that there are certain things that are part of our nature, part of who I am, part of who you are as an individual, that are there to stay, and giving ourselves the permission to experience them. It is about unconditional acceptance for certain things, good and bad. For example, it's about giving oneself unconditional acceptance, even if I experience jealousy and envy toward my best friend. Is it an emotion that I like? No. Is it an emotion that I would rather do without? Absolutely. But is it an emotion that I've experienced? Yeah. I've experienced it toward my closest friends. There are two ways to go about it. One is to reject it and say, well, I can perfect my nature, that I will never feel jealousy towards someone or I care about or anyone else. Or I can say, well, it's part of who I am. It's part of being human. Or another thing, feeling depressed, feeling down. One approach to it is say, it's part of being human, part of who I am. Another thing is to say, I don't want to experience depression ever again, which is the unconstrained vision. Another example is anxiety and stress. You know, before I start classes, I always feel some stress, some anxiety. One way to go about it is to say, I don't want to do this, to experience this anymore. I need to perfect my nature so that I come on and I'm, you know, just feeling very, you know, happy-go-lucky. Another way to go about it is to say, I'm human. Give myself the permission to experience this anxiety. And I said it last time, there are two kinds of people who don't experience these emotions, whether it's jealousy or anxiety or anger or depression. There are two kinds of people, the psychopaths or the numb people and the dead people. It's not the same as resignation, though. You know, just because I feel envy toward my closest friend doesn't mean I need to say, well, you know, I feel that way and I'm going to act accordingly and put them down so that I don't feel envious anymore. No, I have a choice. At that point, when I accept the emotion, I have a choice. I know that I get anxious when I stand in front of an audience. But I have a choice. One choice is to say, I'm not going to teach. I'm not going to stand in front of an audience. I can just literally lock myself up in the room and write. It's more of my comfort zone. But it's also my passion, my mission, and my purpose to spread the word, the positive psychology. And for that, I have to teach. I have to be out there. So I make a choice. I give myself the permission to be human, to be anxious and stressed at times, and then go ahead and teach anyway. Permission to be human. It doesn't mean we need to act according to it. It's not the same as resigning to it. Okay, well, I'm anxious, I'm never going to teach. I'm envious, I'm not going to have any friends, or I'm going to put them down. That's not the approach I'm advocating, for sure. But what I'm saying here is that rejecting our nature, not allowing ourselves to experience unhappiness, not allowing ourselves to experience the anxiety, trying to fight it and say, rejecting it from our lives will ultimately lead to unhappiness. As I said, it's like fighting a Sisyphean battle because no one can avoid feeling unhappy at times. No one can avoid anxiety at times. No one can avoid depression at times. It's part of who we are. And if we accept it, we're much more likely to be able to deal with it effectively. Remember, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. If I try and fight my nature, it will come back even stronger. Whereas if I say, okay, so I experience anxiety, and I come up and I stand here and I experience anxiety for about 2 minutes and then it goes away. Whereas if I kept on fighting it, don't feel anxious, don't feel anxious, don't feel anxious. It's like telling myself, you know, don't think of a pink elephant. It's Dan Wagner's work here in the department, ironic processing. Don't think of a pink elephant. Don't think of a pink elephant. What are you thinking about? You know, pink, don't be anxious. Don't be anxious. Whereas if I say, it's okay. So I'm human. That's all it means. I'm much more likely to be able to deal with it healthfully. There is a problem. You know what the problem is? That society as a whole does not give us the permission to be human. What's going on is something that I call the great deception. Especially in America. We don't give each other the permission. I'm generalizing here. This is the average. I'm not talking about everyone. On the whole, we don't give each other the permission to be human. We don't give each other the permission to be sad. So, and we fall into this trap. When someone asks us, so, what's up? How do we respond? Just great. Even if we're feeling upset, even if we are depressed. So how's it going? Just fine. When I'm actually really stressed out. It's the norm now. You know, someone asked me 2 weeks ago, so how are you doing? Automatic, great. Now, I just lost my mentor. I was doing terribly. But the automatic response. And I just caught myself. I said, wait a minute, I'm not doing great. It's a norm. Now, I'm not saying wearing our heart on our sleeves. So how are you doing? I'm so glad you asked. Come, let me tell you how I'm doing. You know? Finally, someone cares. You know, no one cares about me here. I'm not talking about it, but I'm talking about having some intimate, close friends where we can wear our hearts on our sleeves. Remember, we talked about social support. I'm not saying go to the extreme, you know, share with everyone and that. But having some people where we can be real, who give us the permission to be human. That is critical. What is the great deception that we all put on a smile when sometimes a tear may be more appropriate? And this great deception leads to the Great Depression. Why? Because let's say I'm feeling down, but everyone around me is doing great, right? Because I asked them, how are they doing? They're doing great. And then I don't want to be the odd one out, you know, the only one who's feeling down here. So when someone asks me, how am I doing? I'm also going to say great. And I reinforce that because when other people see me and they're feeling down, say, oh, wow, so he or she's feeling great. I'm the only one who's not feeling great. And I continue the facade. And this great deception leads to the Great Depression, which leads to more deception, and so on and so on in a downward spiral. I told you this class is not about Pollyannish happy-go-lucky. It's about reality. Be real. It's about being true to who we are, to our true, real nature. And who we are as human beings is a collection of emotions. And they're all natural, they're all fine, they're all real. Here is what I want to do now. I want you to actually experience this space of unconditional acceptance. And here is what I mean by unconditional acceptance. It's allowing every single emotion that we have to flow through us, to flow through us freely. And we're going to do an exercise. And the exercise that we're going to do, you can participate in it as much as you like or as little as you like. I want you to try and experientially feel what it means to be in the space of unconditional acceptance. Barry, can you turn down the lights just slightly? In doing this exercise, you may close your eyes, you may leave them open, whatever you feel comfortable. What I want you to do is sit down comfortably in your chair with your back straight as much as possible. Again, close your eyes or leave them open, whatever you're comfortable with. Let's, for a minute, try and enter this space of unconditional acceptance. Feel yourself sitting in your seat and breathe. Breathe deeply. In our fast-paced culture, fast-paced world, we don't take enough time to really, to truly breathe. Take a deep breath to the depth of your stomach, and then breathe out. Breathe a few times. How are you doing? How are you feeling? What emotions are going through your body right now? Pay attention to them, whatever they are, any emotion. Experience that emotion fully. Continue with the deep breaths, breathing into the emotion. You may feel one emotion one moment. In the next moment, you may feel another emotion. Whatever it is, accept it. experience it. Give yourself the permission to be human. Every emotion, every feeling is just fine. In your mind's eye, right now, actually imagine yourself walking out of this classroom today, walking in the yard with the feeling that all your feelings are natural, that all your feelings are real, are fine, that they're a part of human nature. And as you walk outside amidst the snow and the trees and the buildings, as you see your friends and classmates, allow these emotions to flow through you, freely, lightly. See yourself, experience yourself going through these emotions. By experiencing all these emotions, whether the ups or the downs, what you're doing is being a human being. Life as a whole becomes so much lighter, so much simpler, when rather than trying to fight or defeat our nature, we accept our nature, we accept who we are. Take a few more deep breaths, allowing whatever emotion flows through you to flow naturally and freely. Now open your eyes, especially if you're sleeping. It's okay to sleep, that's fine too. We all do it, even Harvard students. Little of it, but we do it. Now, some of you connected to this more than others, some didn't. I wanted to give you a little bit of sense experientially of what this is. I highly recommend this exercise, and I write about this exercise in the draft of the book, to do it by yourself. Give yourself the permission to be human, because as I said, life does become so much simpler, so much easier, not without the trials and tribulations, but it certainly strengthens our immune system so that we can deal with these trials and tribulations in a much healthier, much more effective way. To summarize what permission to be human is, something that you probably, most of you have heard before: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can change, and the wisdom to know the difference. Again, whether you're religious or not, you know, take the God out. This is a very good prescription for permission to be human. Because what it says is that, first of all, how do we identify what our nature is, which is not easy? Give me the wisdom to know the difference. And then to deal with the parts that I can change. So while I cannot change the fact that sometimes I feel jealousy, what I can change is whether I'm benevolent and generous toward my closest friends. While I can't help feeling anxiety or stress or feeling down at times, what I can do is decide to act despite what I'm feeling and to give myself the permission to be human. Let me move on to the final premise. Happiness is and ought to be our ultimate end versus happiness should be a secondary pursuit. Now, the fact that we pursue happiness, that we want happiness, most of us know and agree with. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's right. In other words, this is for you, Nick, and the philosopher, and the other philosophers, just because our nature is that way doesn't mean it ought to be that way. What I'm going to argue for and what many people have argued for is that happiness is the highest end. There's very little disagreement on that. Aristotle, 2,000 years ago, happiness is the meaning and purpose of life, the whole aim and the end of human existence. 2 millennia later, William James, if we were to ask the question, what is human life's chief concern? One of the answers we should receive would be, it is happiness. How to gain, how to keep, how to recover happiness is in fact, for most men at all times, the secret motive of all they do and of all they are willing to endure. We write constitutions to safeguard our pursuit of happiness. We spend millions and billions of dollars whether it's the medical industry or whether it's the psychology industry, focused on trying to make us happier. And this is not peculiar to the West. The Dalai Lama, whether one believes in religion or not, whether one believes in this religion or that religion, the very purpose of our life is happiness. The very motion of our life is towards happiness. Now, most people would agree that the motion in our life is toward happiness, but many people wouldn't agree that it's a good thing. Many people would say, well, this is part of our nature, but it doesn't mean we need to pursue happiness. We need to pursue higher ideals. And what I'm going to argue for here is that we need to pursue high ideals, but happiness is and ultimately should be our highest goal. Why is that? What's good about happiness, or more generally, what's good about positive emotions? And here we get to some research. But before we get to research, let me say the self-evident. By definition, it feels good to feel good. So this is justification enough, for most people, justification enough why we should pursue happiness. It makes us feel good. It's better than feeling bad. But there's more to it. There's more to it, and here I'm relying on the work of Barbara Fredrickson. She's a psychologist researcher at the University of Michigan. That's phenomenal work. You think you read her for the first week, or you're reading her for this week. And she elaborates on her broaden and build theory, but I want to touch on it a little bit. What is broaden and build? What she says is that when we experience positive emotions as opposed to negative emotions, our view of the world, the way we experience things, the internal, the transformative side rather than the informative side, has a much broader perspective on reality. And this broad perspective we build on. For example, we look outside to meet more people when we're in a positive mood. And we build social relationships. And what she said is that historically, this broaden and build has strengthened us, evolutionarily speaking. Positive emotions have always made us stronger and more effective, and they still do today. And here is what she says in her article. We should work to cultivate positive emotions in ourselves and in those around us, not just as end states in themselves, because it feels good, but also as a means to achieving psychological growth and improved psychological and physical health over time. I call this broaden and build theory of positive emotions because positive emotions appear to broaden people's momentary thought action repertoires and build their enduring personal resources. Through experience of positive emotions, people transform themselves, becoming more creative, knowledgeable, resilient, socially integrated and healthy individuals. So positive emotions, happiness, has numerous benefits beyond just the fact that it makes us feel good. Let me elaborate on some of the ones that she mentions. First, it also helps us overcome negative emotions. So remember what I talked about in terms of negative psychology working from the negative to zero and positive psychology from zero to one? But I said that positive psychology also helps us overcome negative experiences in that it strengthens our immune system. So it doesn't take us only, well, now I'm over anxiety, now I can start to feel better. Cultivate my self-esteem, resilience, happiness. No, if I cultivate my self-esteem, my resilience, my happiness, if I exercise regularly and or do meditation, then I am more likely to be able to deal with the negative more effectively. One of the reasons, because let's take depression, for instance. The opposite of broaden and build is narrow and constrict. When we are depressed, when we have negative emotions, we narrow and constrict, and for good reasons. So for instance, a million years ago, our forefathers and mothers were in the field, and suddenly there was a lion in front of them. Immediately anxiety, right? Stress. Narrow and constrict. The only thing I think about is that lion in front of me. That's good. I don't want to be thinking now, well, you know, I wonder how my kid is doing back home. You know, I wonder how this new painting that I painted on on the wall is doing right now. I wonder if it's going to be famous a million years from now. You know, you don't want to have these thoughts about prestige and success. You want to be thinking about that lion. The fight or flight response comes in, narrow and constrict. You're only thinking about one thing, nothing else, and you start running or fighting. That's healthy, that's good, and it's important at times. But what if my girlfriend just left me? And after 6 months that she has left me, I'm still narrowing and constricting. I'm still thinking about that, because what depression often does is lead to this narrow and constrict. And this narrow and constrict, because I'm only brooding on it, only thinking about it, leads to further depression, and so on and so on. And I don't get out of it. Now, positive moods come in and get us out of this narrow and constrict, and what they do is broaden and build so that I think about other things in my life, other things that are happening that are good, other opportunities that I have. Remember, the passive victim versus active agent. And that helps to reverse that cycle and helps me get over it eventually to feel better. Again, not to take away the importance of experiencing the pain and going through these motions. It's healthy to go through negative emotions because it's also, there's a cleansing part to it. It's not healthy to just, well, she left me, I'm depressed. Okay, now I'm not depressed anymore and I move on. That's not the way it works. So what the happiness does is get us out of this narrow and constrict, the fight or flight, and gets us to a better place so that we can start building again. How do we do it? Exercise helps us feel better. Humorous film, you know, talking to friends and laughing. And very often these things can get us out of this narrow space. Cultivating resilience, meditation can help. And various other techniques, cognitive behavioral therapy approaches can help, which we'll talk about. We'll talk about all these things. But positive emotions don't just get us from zero to one, they can actually get us out of this downward spiral of depression and narrowing and depression and narrowing. Also increased creativity. One of the things that Fredrickson does in her article, which you'll read about, is she challenges the depressed creator archetype. It doesn't mean that there weren't people who were very depressed and very creative. There were many of them. But what she's arguing for is saying, all things being equal, we're more likely to be creative if you were happy. So in other words, if Proust was happier, he could have actually been more creative than he was being depressed. And there are experiments that show that. One experiment, what Fredrickson did, she went to internists. And the internists at a hospital were giving a very complicated case of a liver disease, one that would really require them, in order to identify what it was, to think deeply about the issue. And she divided the internists into three groups. One group got candy, just to make them feel better. The second group read an excerpt about the humanitarian importance of medicine, why it's such a significant profession. And the third group was a control group. And what she found with this tiny intervention was that the first group of internists were much more likely to come up with a solution to the problem. They didn't reach immediate closure on the problem because they were in the broaden and build category. The same she found in other research after watching a humorous piece on TV. People were more creative, were learning better after having a conversation, a fun conversation with a friend. Being in a positive mood, having positive emotions actually contributes to our creativity. Also motivation and energy. I mean, think about the last time you felt down. How motivated and energized were you? You know, compared to a time when you were feeling good. And the sum total of this, of creativity, of motivation, is success. There's actual research that shows that people are more successful in the workplace, for instance, more likely to achieve promotion, more likely to come up with good solutions to problem, pay more likely to be higher, with an increase in positive emotions. Why? Because it makes them more motivated, because it increases their creativity, because it gets them out of the space to form relationships. And finally, and we'll talk a lot about that later, there's certainly a connection between positive emotions and physical health. Let me just finish by talking about other people. 2 minutes. Okay, so it makes me feel better and do well. What about others? Well, it is not the fact that if I'm more happy, others are less happy. It's not a zero-sum game. On the contrary, as the Buddha said, thousands of candles can be lighted from a single candle, and the life of the candle will not be shortened. Happiness never decreases by being shared. Happiness, like laughter, like smiles, can and ought to be contagious. We can have better relationships if we bring positive emotions to our life, improve the lives of others. Alice Eisen, one of the founders of positive psychology, found that people, when you put them in a positive mood, actually become more generous. When they're generous, they actually improve their mood. As their mood improves, they become more generous, and so on, in an upward spiral. So happiness doesn't just benefit us, it also benefits others. I want to end with one of my favorite quotes by one of the leading leaders of the 20th century, and a person who certainly has made a lot of difference in other people's lives. And he talks indirectly about spreading happiness. And what Mahatma Gandhi said was, be the change you want to see in the world. If you want a better world, if you want a happier world, the change starts within. I'll see you on Thursday.